R.G.
And joining me now in the KRVS studios, I am both honored and delighted to say, is writer Cheryl St. Germain. She is receiving the 2018 Louisiana Writer Award this weekend at the Louisiana Book Festival. It's on Saturday, and if you happen to be going to Baton Rouge or you're going to the book festival already, you can see her receive that award Saturday at 9 o'clock in the State Capitol House Chamber. So a great, great honor because you are amidst some of the most amazing Louisiana writers. This is the 19th time they've given the award. The first one was to Ernest Gaines, I believe.
Yes.
And in addition to Ernest Gaines, James Lee Burke, Shirley Ann Grau, Yusuf Komunyakaa, William Joyce, John Biganay, Daryl Bourke, and so many others have received this award, and you are getting it now. I know there are people listening right now who do know your work and know you, but for those who do not, Cheryl has published numerous books of poetry. I have my stack here on the table to prove that. You have written two memoirs, collections of essays. You've edited anthologies with others, and you have a collection of essays that will be published this year that accompany a book of poetry that was published earlier this year in the springtime, The Small Door of Your Death. You are originally from New Orleans, actually Kenner, and
right.
We'll talk more about that. And after you got your PhD from Texas, you spent some time here in Lafayette. I think it was your first full-time job.
That's right. That's right.
You were an English professor at then USL. But then in 1994, I think, you left Louisiana in the broad daylight. Never to return. No, not really. You've visited many, many times, but you've made your life in Midwestern colleges since that time. And you now direct in Pittsburgh, I believe. You're the director of the MFA program in creative writing at Chatham University. But we want to welcome you back to the campus because I know so many remember you very well, fondly, and you inspired so many students here. You'll actually be reading tonight at Achilles Print Studio, and that is in the Oil Center. I think it's on Oil Center Drive, actually. That reading will be at 7 o'clock. So your friends, your former students, people who have read your work, and people who will find themselves interested by what you say today are welcome to attend the reading tonight. Even though you've lived away for, I think, 24, 25 years now, you've never stopped writing about Louisiana. And I love a line, I think, from the press release that accompanied the announcement of the award. You said, it wouldn't be a stretch to say I owe my vocation as a writer to Louisiana. And I want to mention an essay that I hope we'll talk about a little bit later. In Navigating Disaster, a collection of essays, you're out in the swamp with Greg Gearward. And he says, "Your swamp's not my swamp."
That's right, yeah.
And it's an amazing essay, lots of things to talk about. But I'd like to start off by having you describe your very first particular swamp that you grew up in so that we can have an understanding of where you came from. So what was that swamp like?
Yeah, I'll tell you. Thanks, Judith. I'm really happy to be here and back to be in Lafayette. I miss it. But the swamp, what Greg was saying to me was, you know, his swamp was obviously the Atchafalaya, and he took it upon himself to teach me everything in the world about the Atchafalaya. In fact, as we're sitting here, I'm wearing something that he gave me. It's an alligator button that reminds me to be strong. But my swamps were really swamps of drinking and drugs and the kind of swamp that developed within my family. So they weren't literal swamps, but it was the Swamp Songs, the memoir that I wrote, tells the story of my sister driving into a swamp, which was alongside Airline Highway, and not being able to swim and having to – it's almost hilarious now, but at the time it wasn't so funny – having to hang on until the police came and pulled her out. And I thought to myself, that's always been afraid – I've always been afraid that that would happen to me, that I would fall into those swamps of addiction, of alcoholism. As much as I love Louisiana and my family, there have been, you know, my father died of alcoholism, my brother of a drug overdose, and my son recently of a drug overdose. So I I think that's the swamps that I was talking about, trying to pull myself out of. And I think Greg really wanted me to see a more positive swamp. Mm-hmm. And it was I'm ever grateful to him for that.
Well, and also to set the scene where all of this happened, when you talk about your family, when you talk about those different kinds of swamps, set the scene literally. Describe, because there is water involved here too, but your family was set in a very particular place in Kenner, in New Orleans. Help us understand, just describe that physically.
Right.
What was that
right.
like?
Well, it was Kenner. I was born in New Orleans, but we moved to Kenner when I was 5. And my mother still lives in that house. I just came from visiting her. It's on Williams Boulevard, which stretches between – it was 3 blocks from Pontchartrain, Lake Pontchartrain, and about a mile from the Mississippi River. So I grew up between those two bodies of water and always – was walking to the lake. And I've written a number of poems about how that body of water influenced me, just the things that I would see there, the crabs that were feeding on the detritus in the water, the dead things, and yet transforming that into something really beautiful, white and sweet and good to eat, and even though the waters were polluted. You know, and it was very much farm when I was there. Now, if you go to Williams Boulevard, it's very much box stores and incredibly commercial. And I think my mother's house is one of the few houses remaining on those 3 blocks that we sort of lived in and were part of, where there were friends and all of that, that is not now a commercial establishment. But when we lived there, it was a farm with horses across. There were blackberry bushes in the back. There were ditches in front that where crawfish lived, and we would get the crawfish out of the ditch. There were king snakes everywhere. It was I spent time climbing in mimosa trees and some taller trees to read, and so did my mother. So it was nothing like it is now, really. Walking to the lake was a meditative time for me as a young girl, and it was very rural. Now there's a casino there, and it's just, I've written a little bit about this in Swamp Songs, how mm-hmm. that place has changed. And my mother is still there, and she loves it because it's convenient for her, things are close by. But I'm always a little sad when I visit, because I remember that the blackberry bushes and the king snakes and the mm-hmm. crawfish and the ditches that were – the water was dark, and just like swamps, but you looked into them and you could see your face reflected back, and it wasn't – the waters of the swamp and the Mississippi there and the – also, the lake, they were dark waters. They were not swift-moving waters. And when I moved later up north, those waters were just more swift-moving and brisk and not like those waters that I grew up with. And I think, when I didn't certainly think this when I was a child, but looking back on how I became a writer, I really think that those slow-moving waters and the fact that there were so many floods and hurricanes and you had land that was sometimes water and sometimes not made me deeply comfortable with ambiguity. And, so it's not surprising that I became a poet. Of course, I also had a mother who loved to read. That's a whole other yeah. thing. But partly what I mean about about Louisiana. Yeah. And
well, I guess I wanted to give people a sense of where you came from, where you grew up, because it does inform really every part of your writing life. So could you tell us, from this swamp, from this family, from everything you've described, what do you write about? Again, for those people who don't know the flow of your writing, what have you chosen to write about in particular?
Yeah. The first poems I think that were successful of mine were poems about Lake Pontchartrain and the Mississippi, thinking about the curve of the Mississippi and loving it and feeling almost an undescribable comfort and love for this place. I mean, I've lived away for a long time, but I feel more at home here in this landscape. So I wrote about the Mississippi. I wrote about the lake. I I wrote about black cherry picking with my brother. Mm-hmm. And I also thought about it metaphorically because we both struggled with our own sort of darknesses and just the idea of plucking darkness and being stung sometimes by those thorns suggested something to me about some darkness that got mm-hmm. inside of us together. Mm-hmm. So I also wrote about carnival, wrote about being a Cajun because my father was Cajun, but his grandparents were deaf. And so we never learned how to speak Cajun, as they say, you know, although French was my father's first language. And so I had to come, and my Cajun grandparents moved to New Orleans, which is where my father was born. So even though my grandmother was from Ville Platte, we didn't visit much. And so later I had to learn about that part of my life and my heritage. And I wrote poems about that, about Cajun, what I learned about my Cajun family.
I think what also strikes people too is there's darkness in some of those early poems, but there's an incredible joy of sensuality and particularly of food and tastes and ingredients. And that you pull that so beautifully from your heritage, whether it's the Cajun or the New Orleans.
Yeah, there's early poems about food, red beans and rye, mother's red beans and rice. I remember watching her make those red beans and rice. And
there was a detail in that poem that is and I know it got you published in part because of that detail. And I'm sure we have all done it, but just never admitted it or written about it. Can you tell us what that detail was?
Do you mean the blood?
Yes.
So I'm watching my mother cook in the poem, and I can see she's sad. And she's not paying attention, and she's chopping up the onions and the garlic, and she makes a mistake, and she just kind of cuts her thumb a little bit, and there's a little blood, and she just puts it all into the red beans, the garlic, the onion, and the blood. And I wanted to put that detail in there because I think, again, both literally and metaphorically, that's what she did when she cooked at the time. It was her blood that was going into this, you know.
So, well, I think anyone from here who's ever chopped onions and prepared a gumbo or red beans, something like that has happened.
And there are poems about gumbo, making a mm-hmm. roux. I thought a lot about how long it takes to make a roux, a really good dark roux. And I just remember thinking as I was stirring and stirring how my mother had done this and my grandmother and my great-grandmother, because we go back about 200 years in Louisiana, and just this ancient gesture. And that thinking about that drew a poem out of me. But I've also written about bread pudding with whiskey sauce.
If you go through your poems, I think you've sort of mentioned jambalaya and most dishes around here.
Yeah, there's a lot. I even talked about iced tea, the sweet iced tea. There's the poem Going Home, which is where, when my family talks like this, they talk de cause around the corner, and it's a real New Orleans accent. And for a while, I was ashamed of that. I thought, no one will hire me if I talk like this. And but after a little while, I began to realize that I loved that language, how slow it was and sloppy in a very beautiful way. It was how my mama talked. And so I wrote a poem about the language and the slowness of everything from the river to the way people talked and moved, and just glorifying in that. New Orleans is nothing if not a sensuous and sensual city. And I think that's, you find a lot of that in the early, in my early poems.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from, because I'm fascinated at watching your development as a poet, as a writer, when you go through all of these books. The early poems do seem to be focused on certain sensual things and certain events and moments. And then it becomes not enough to write like that. It feels like you just begin to swell and develop as a writer, and you seem to be exploring other aspects of that life in New Orleans. And maybe it's when you went away, when you left New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yeah.
Did you find something changed in your writing, or you wrote more prose, or?
Well, I think it was maturity more than leaving. I think I turned to writing prose because it allowed for, in some ways, a more developed and nuanced discussion of something that that I couldn't get with the poems. And I continued to write both. I wrote the first memoir when I was in Iowa, and I think that we almost always write out of desire, and I was longing for Louisiana. I mean, even today, if you were to go in my house, I have the Jazz Fest posters up. I have Greg Girard's photographs up there. I have cypress wood. I have collections of Mardi Gras beads. My house, if you walk into it in Pittsburgh, you would think you were in New Orleans. And it's a way of keeping close. They're symbols. Those things are symbols for things that I loved. And so when I was in Iowa, away from Louisiana, I found myself writing about it and writing about things that both were loving, I loved, and that were disturbing to me. I started thinking more about how my voice had developed and what a role hurricanes might have played in it, for example. And my father was in the National Guard, and I remembered him having to leave and save people, as I understood it when I was a kid, and how scary things were. And I began thinking about some of the more difficult things that my family wishes I wouldn't talk about, and finding a more nuanced way to talk about it. And I began, I also developed a relationship with Greg Girard, who we've mentioned, and he taught me so much about the Atchafalaya. And even though I'd come back always to visit my mother, I always visited Greg, and he always took me out on the Atchafalaya. And so there were poems, and I wrote several poems about that place, which has become my favorite place in the world. And I have traveled all over the world, but with students mostly. I do that every year, but that's my favorite place.
And the Atchafalaya.
The Atchafalaya. Mm-hmm. And so I've written a bit about that. I also, there were environmental pieces in there because this was later, but the Gulf oil spill, there's essays about that. There's a poem, a long poem about that. There's pieces about Katrina. My brother's house was destroyed in Katrina, and my mother had to evacuate for a really long time. So I wanted to do more. I didn't want to write politicized poetry, but I thought I could make some ground into people's hearts by writing lyric essays. And so I started doing that. And I quite frankly, I just grew more. I got older, and I wanted more than just some of those celebratory poems that were a lot of fun to write, mm-hmm. and I still read them, and I'll probably read a couple of them tonight. But I like what Franz Kafka said about literature, that it should be like an axe to break the frozen sea within you. So I started taking more risks, and I hope being more brave and saying things that I felt needed to be said that I didn't hear said.
And I like what you said about reaching out to touch other people's hearts and finding a way, because my next question has to do with that. There are a lot of people who write memoirs these days. It's extremely popular and they're everywhere. And there are lots about Louisiana too, and growing up in various parts of Louisiana. But I want to say that very few of those cross the blood-brain barrier. It's like their swamp stays their swamp.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like my swamp. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask you about what you do in your writing that so powerfully lets other people feel that it is one swamp, that you're not just writing about one particular swamp, but you cross that barrier into the heart, into the brain. Something happens in your writing, and what you said there about wanting to touch it, it must have something to do with that. And so when you write, what drives the way you write? How and why you write? What drives that touches us?
It's a great question. I think it's really important to tell people what you've learned as a human being in whatever way. Maybe you paint it, maybe you sing it, maybe you write it. But I feel like if you come to the end of your life and you haven't done that, that's a kind of particular hell. You can't. So I don't tell everything, in these memoirs, but I try to think about, however painful it might be, what are glorious? What are the things that might speak to other people? So there's no use in telling a story that's only going to harm or hurt someone if it's not offering a gift to someone else. So I like to think that so, for example, with my son's death, I didn't want to write poems that were simply whining and mired in grief. I thought a lot of people are not recovering and maybe we need to have a book about not recovering and what that's like for a mother and a son, and maybe that will speak to some people. So I'm always thinking about a reader. Writing has been a healing process for me, but I'm also a professional writer, I would say, you know. So I'm always thinking about a reader. I'm always wanting to share with them. And you talk about the blood-brain barrier, and I think I try, and I don't know if I'm always successful, but I try to use words in such a way that they're reaching for a spiritual dimension and a physical dimension and they work on an intellectual level as well. I love what somebody once said about Moby Dick, it's a damn good fish story. And of course, it's a lot more than a fish story, but it's got this veneer of accessibility and teeming with all kinds of stuff underneath. And that's what I like to do. I like to think about, I want the pieces to be accessible, but I want them to be teeming with stuff like a swamp, you know, all kinds of richness there should people wish to look there. I think the mistake that some memoirists can make is that when they think they're just writing about themselves and not that you're a lens onto something larger. And that's something I may not, again, always be successful, but I try to think this is about something larger than me. And so maybe that's one of the things that I do that helps to cross that blood-brain mm-hmm. barrier.
Well, I mean, those are some interesting things you've said. Because there is nothing wrong with something that helps a person heal in writing their own particular story. But transforming it to take it to that next level as a professional writer, where it will make us all feel embraced and that even though your particulars are very unique, there is an emotional bedrock that I don't have to have experienced that.
Right.
But I feel not only what you're saying, but I feel it touches my swamp.
That's what I want. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I'm hoping. And that's the dance that it is a kind of a dance. It's how deep can you go into the situation without losing someone, you know, and how can you make it universal enough that people can speak to it? It's, you know, sometimes when we have dreams and we're trying to interpret our dreams and we get all literal, oh, that's about my Aunt Mabel was, you know, but if you always look at your dreams as something more archetypal and, you know, then it tells you a lot more about yourself, about the culture, and that's what I like to think about when I write, although that sounds really intellectual. It's not
you are a teacher, and you are trying to impart these things to your students all the time.
But I teach, you know, I teach women in recovery, especially. I have a program that I developed called the Maenads, and these are women who have gone through a recovery process and want to continue writing. And we talk about this all the time because some of the things they write, and they're not professional writers, are really good for their souls. They're not pieces that would speak necessarily to others, but
so there is great value in that.
There's absolutely mm-hmm. great value in that, and we also teach in the jails in that program and in prisons. And there's a great value to just taking the time to meditate for a moment and write, and without a thought that you're going to publish it. You know, so one of the things I talk about and I teach is trauma writing. Is how do you write both professionally and then for these other groups that are not within the university? You know, how is it that you can write about a trauma, whether it's a personal trauma or a cultural trauma, like what's just been happening in the last couple of weeks with the murders of in our Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh was just 100 feet from Chatham, where I teach, that this happened. You know, so how does one write about something like that? How does one talk about it? Both if you were personally affected and just as a member of the human race, you know, that kind of loss. we were talking earlier before we turned the mics on about the opiate epidemic, and also there's been a lot of very high-profile suicides we've seen lately. And I really think it's a spiritual crisis, and I think there are books that can have us enter into that and think about it and reflect. And, you know, you never know what's going to come out of that, but I just believe very deeply that it's a good thing to linger and think and consider. And, you know, just going into that darkness, whatever you want to call it, for a while and staying there, you can learn so much.
I want to tell people before we continue, my guest is writer Cheryl St. Germain. She is going to receive the 2018 Louisiana Writer Award this weekend at the Louisiana Book Festival. She taught here at UL for a few years and is originally from New Orleans, has lived away for many, many years, writes about Louisiana in nearly all of her works, and she will be giving a reading this evening in Lafayette at the Achilles Print Studio. That's in the Oil Center, 321 Oil Center Drive, 7 o'clock. All are invited. She'll be reading from her work, and then there will be a question and answer period afterward. Will you have any of your books there?
Yes,
you will.
I will. Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, you describe, just as beautifully as you write, you describe beautifully about how you think about writing, and you're very thoughtful about it. And I know, I have heard from some of your students just how powerful a teacher you are and how much you have affected them. You talk about, and this may have been in the press release as well, a very interesting moment when you were in school, in college, and your teacher was Tim Gautreaux, who also won the Louisiana Book Award, I think, as well. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's a very simple thing that suddenly make you see how you should start to move forward. Yeah. Can you describe that moment in his class?
Yeah. Well, he put something on the board that he called a mush graph. And it was – on one side was – insect. I think he had a roach, actually.
Of course.
And then he sort of drew a line, and then on the other side was love. And he wanted to – he said that it was easier and better to write about a roach than it was to write about love, and which sounds – I mean, I don't know if people can see this, but I knew what he meant by that was that you needed to be specific in order to reach people, that just to write about it was a light went off in my head, because I didn't fully understand at that point how powerful something specific and concrete could be, as opposed to something abstract like love and beauty and the things that you can't touch. And so that was there's not much that I remember from my time at Southeastern, how much although I loved it, but I remember Tim's class, and I remember that mushcraft and him walking back and forth, and he also said to me that at some point, he didn't tell me to necessarily do this, but he said somebody should write about Kenner, you know. And I remember when my Swamp Songs first came out, there's an essay in there about Kenner, and my mother said, "Why in the world would you write about Kenner?" And I said, "Well, because no one else has, you know. Everyone's written about New Orleans. But this is the place where we grew up, where there were airplanes constantly because we were right by the airport. And there were some things I could say about that place that no one else had said." And so that sort of, even though it was very specific about, you know, writing about Ken or writing about a place that no one has ever gone, I also thought about it in terms of writing in a way that no one has about a place. And I've tried I have written about New Orleans, but I've tried to avoid the cliches that people fall into and, you know, oh, let's just talk about the French Quarter and this and that. And I've tried to, I think at one point I wrote a piece, I don't know if I published it, about the weeds that are along, when you walk along the levee in the French Quarter, which what we call weeds, but I would call actually beautiful flowers that you would see, you know. So I've tried to sort of complicate things in that way.
But, you know, that reminds me a bit of it, because a lot of people write about the caricatures, the French Quarter or something that we think of as New Orleans. But it's like the old thing, don't stare directly at the star, otherwise you can't see it.
Exactly.
You know?
And
the things you describe, any of us who have spent any time in New Orleans know those weeds. We know the waters you describe in Kinner. We know Kinner.
Yeah.
And Kinner and Metairie and all of those places around there create the people that make New Orleans so unique.
Yeah.
And you see that in other books like Confederacy of Dunces. It's the people who live in the little neighborhoods, you know, the poorer neighborhoods,
yeah,
the ones that have the weeds and the sidewalk cracks and that make that very special gumbo of a place. And absolutely, that's what you feel when you read your essays about New Orleans and that absolutely very successful at that.
There's a genuineness there, you know, I mean, that you don't find sometimes when people are writing about New Orleans the writ large, you know. I mean, when my mother and I went to I don't want to make this commercial, so I won't, but we went to a little neighborhood restaurant that we always go to.
In Kinner.
In Metairie, actually, in Metairie. And that's where we always go to have our soft shell crabs and unfortunately, it's not the season, but I'll have raw oysters and gumbo and all of that. And we don't go to New Orleans to do that. And this is a place, there's no tourists there. It's just local people. And even in Kenner, there's a Fisherman's Cove place where my sister used to be a waitress. And you see just the most genuine people there. They're not, you know, again, not the tourists and not the people who come for the big experience. It's what surrounds New Orleans that – I don't know if I'd go so far as to say it makes New Orleans, but it certainly nestles within and shapes it in some kinds of ways. And people ignore it. They, you know, say, oh, I'm flying to New Orleans. But they're landing in Kenner. You know?
Landing in Kenner.
And their plane is going to make the walls of my mother's house shake. And then they, you know, they get transported immediately into New Orleans.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So.
And you describe, I mean, one of my favorite essays is describing the restaurant you worked in at the airport.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
In the 70s, I guess,
yes,
it was early
70s.
But it is the word genuine. Everything rings true when you read your essays about New Orleans. Those are real people. And again, when you think of Mardi Gras, people think of St. Charles and the big floats that go by. But you describe Mardi Gras where you grew up and that there were parades there and people had full-blown Mardi Gras experiences right there on that little street in that little neighborhood.
Yeah, and my father was in Pegasus, the crew of Pegasus, and I have an essay where I talk about that experience of waiting for his float to come around and for him to recognize me. And when I was 14, going to a ball for the first time and dancing with my father, who was – I mean, we were not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but he managed to get into this crew, and he was a duke, and I was dancing with him, and it was just an amazing experience.
But I think it makes us all understand that experience of New Orleans is not just for St. Charles or the Comus Ball, or that everyone in New Orleans participates in that fully.
And it's family. It's it's not just, you know, people getting drunk and all of that. It's a father who dresses up as a pregnant woman and 1 year, and a gorilla the next, which is what my father did. And, you know, my mother dressing up as a gypsy and making the sandwiches and then, you know, sitting out there and, just throw me something, mister. And also the Cajun Mardi Gras, which I've been to and I've written about as well.
Beautiful essay about the Iota women's Mardi Gras.
The women's,
right, exactly.
And Timamu, and I have to thank Barry Ansaleh for that because he took me out there the first time and I've been a few times since and... Yeah, really nice.
I don't want to tell people the books we're talking about of your essays of New Orleans. The first one, Swamp Songs, The Making of an Unruly Woman, really describes a lot of these details about Kenner and where you grew up in the Mardi Gras. And then your second memoir, Navigating Disaster, 16 Essays of Love and a Poem of Despair, deals with a lot of things, but a lot of these are in the aftermath of Katrina and responding to everything that happened to your family and New Orleans. And a lot of books came out of that period, but you wanted to do something a little different with these essays.
Yeah. I mean, I like essays, you know. I think and these are, I would call them linked essays, mm-hmm. but the problem with writing a book or a memoir that's just one uninterrupted narrative is that you're forced to leave so much out, and you're forced to construct a narrative that may or may not represent the truth, because I believe that we have multiple persons inside of us, and I think there are multiple ways to talk about things, and so that's why I like. So first of all, what was different about it? It's a memoir, but it's a memoir and linked essays, and you know I had experiences with students. I travel with students every year, and I brought them to New Orleans after Katrina, and they were coming as tourists, and I was not, and so there's an essay about that. There's an essay about my husband, who was Dutch and who came from, you know, his land is a land of low land that was flooded, and the Dutch actually came to help after Katrina, just as people from Louisiana went to the Netherlands to help them in 1953 when they had a catastrophic flood. So there's a piece about that, which wouldn't have gone along with the piece about my students.
You know, we don't really live our lives like a novel either.
No. So I teach a course that's actually called The Lyric and Formally Adventurous Essay. And I like to do things with essays that are non-traditional, whether it be constructing them like lyrics or segmenting them, because I just want to acknowledge that sometimes the best way to tell a story is not from A to Z, but in pieces. You know, mm-hmm. So there's also around this time the Gulf oil spill occurred, which there's a piece in there. The poem of despair is called Midnight Oil, and it's about that, the horrific destruction of wildlife and flora and fauna, and then of people's lives as well. Mm-hmm. And around that time, my son was sort of sinking into some deep troubles, and there's a piece that talks a little bit about that. It talks about my brother's home and his life, because he died. He died actually a couple of weeks before Katrina, and then his house was completely destroyed. And yeah, so navigating disaster, it's sort of ways to navigate the disasters in your life. So,
and you're again going back to your detail, and you're understanding that the detail makes these things touch the heart. Those are some of the most powerful descriptions of homes and not just homes, but the way people must have responded looking, feeling when they looked at their houses and the way things were is extremely profound, your essays. These are all available. People can find them.
Yes, yep. Mm-hmm. Amazon has them, and the new one. I think Navigating Disaster is out of print, but you might be able to find some.
And that one actually, that was published by Louisiana Literature, so
yes.
Louisiana Press published
yes.
that one.
Yes, and I think Jack Bedell, who is the editor, said they were going to do another one, but so right now it's out of print, although, like I said, I think you can probably find a used copy mm-hmm. online.
Or at the library,
yes.
That's always a good place to go.
Yeah.
Again, my guest, writer Cheryl St. Germain, talking about her body of work. She is receiving the 2018 Louisiana Writer Award this weekend at the Louisiana Book Festival, and we'll be reading tonight, 7 o'clock, at Achilles Print Studio in the Oil Center. We're all invited to attend. Are you just going to be reading poetry, or are you going to read some of your lyric essays?
I think tonight I'm just going to read poetry. Mm-hmm. I have I've gone back and forth between that, and I think for a reading it's probably better to stick mostly to one genre.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I would encourage people to find some of your essays as well, because they will touch your heart as you hoped and intended on so many different levels about Louisiana, about our particular and common swamps that we all have. Yeah. Now, you may not have written as a child, but I love some of your descriptions about how you thought as a child that gave me a sense of a developing writer anyway. And I'm not sure many of us could write about ourselves as a child in the way that you did on Williams Boulevard in New Orleans, picking the blackberries, whatever it was you were doing. And you have some really interesting moments where you're looking at a green lizard the one we see all over Louisiana.
Yeah.
And most of us just look at it. It's a little curious. We see it, you know, its little throat kind of go up, and then we move on. But you didn't. You didn't. And you have a lovely essay talking about your relationship for your entire conscious life with lizards.
Yeah.
And it becomes a metaphor. And just tell us a bit about that and how you thought about lizards as a child, because it really, to me, is very indicative of you as a writer.
Yeah, well, I always was amazed by the natural world. Even though I wouldn't have known how to say that as a child, but I was amazed every time I picked a blackberry. These are free. They just, like, they're good. You know, where did they come from? And those little sensitive plants that you touch and they close up, and the fauna that I saw around. And so we had lots of these lizards. I think they're called green anoles, although my parents argued about what to call them. One of the things, you know, that these lizards do is they pump. They do this pumping thing, which is like I understand it to be a mating ritual, but I didn't know what it was about. And they have this little red sac that pumps out. And the kinds of things I thought I would be lying there looking at it, and I thought, that's what it looks like when I blow bubble gum. You know, and it's just like ways of connecting, and this particular lizard would change colors depending on where it was, and you know, sometimes it was brown if it was on brown leaves, and if it was on the grass it was green, and I thought, yeah, that's a little bit like me when I'm getting a tan. I was out there with my Johnson's baby oil, which is horrible getting the tan, and the lizard would be right next to me, and so there were. I think the point in that essay was that as a young girl, I was always thinking of bridges and connections with the natural, whereas my brothers would, you know, throw firecrackers at the lizards and blow them up and think that was really funny. And I think they figured out some kind of way to make the lizard clamp onto their ears so that wear them as lizard earrings. And it just kind of thinking about and wondering if that was a gender thing, you know, that whereas I tried to find bridges of connection, my brothers were more interested in destroying or torturing.
And I think any of us who have brothers remember the lizard phase. but I'm not sure it's just so much of an issue of gender, but an issue of, as you were saying, someone who's constantly making bridges and connections between the natural world and yourself and creating metaphor at a really young age.
Yes. You know, and my mother was a big reader and read to me before I even knew what words were about and gave me poetry books. And I think I was, from a very young age, a metaphor-making machine. I mean, to me, and still to this day, I believe in the power of metaphors. The way that we explain things to kids, we compare it to something they don't know to something they do know. And it's I remember my son saying to me once, actually, Mom, everything's not a metaphor, you know. And I was like, yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
But, you know, I find metaphors really powerful ways of knowing. And as a kid, I was doing that sort of naturally without even knowing what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was just a lovely essay. And I think that's in Navigating Disaster. You're at a writing retreat here in Louisiana that I think very few people knew about or know about. And you were musing
right.
This lizard that appeared.
Studio in the Woods, which is a beautiful retreat in Algiers. And I was there a couple times, actually, and was watching. It's just set right near the levee just there's a forest there, and it's really a beautiful rural place full of
lizards
and birds and all kinds of things, you know.
Well, it was an amazing essay and really, like I said, gave some understanding and insight into you as a person who always made those connections and continued to do that. And that was important, not just telling a story, but making those connections. You weren't just describing the lizard, but how does that fit? How are we all connected?
And that's really remained very important to me.
Mm-hmm. You did and again, I guess I associated that middle period so much with your essays, but you did just recently publish the book, The Small Door of Your Death, which, as you mentioned, is about your son, mm-hmm. Gray. Mm-hmm. He passed away 4 years ago. You've talked about wanting to transform things that you experience into gifts through your writing. What was your process in this? The poems are, I think I described them to you. You said they were a bit like water, but I felt like I was hearing one of those meditation bells. But each poem was just this true, pure, that was just the way it felt, you know, yeah. The emotional response I had to each one. How did you begin to gather those thoughts and emotions to create poetry?
Well, I've kept journals all my life. I mean, I have 50 years of journals. And so when I learned that he had died, he died in Texas, in Dallas, where he was living, and I flew down the very next day and I just happened to have a new journal, and I just was crying and crying and just writing and writing and writing and not thinking about poems, just thinking about him and, you know, our life together and throughout the whole process of planning his service you know, which had some joy to it because it turned out people really loved him, and he was an important member of the music community in Dallas and in Denton. And, you know, so getting to know some of his friends and former girlfriends, and in fact, the painting that is on the cover is a painting from a former girlfriend. So there were ability to connect with others. So I wrote, and more for myself. And then I got back home, and I thought, I want to honor him in some way by writing, and I want to write the truth and of how complicated he was, that he was an addict and alcoholic, but he was also a beautiful, smart, funny, talented person. And we don't always think of addicts in that way. Once you call someone an addict or an alcoholic, that's how you see them. And so I thought the book might have a value in complicating that. And I also, any mother or anyone who has someone like this in their family knows it's complicated to love someone like that. It's really hard. And you do it, but it's hard because there's this veneer of the substance abuse. And so I wanted to write about that in a loving way, but a truthful way. But I still was grieving so much. I couldn't write any of that. So I went back to my journals and when he was born, and for many months, I just transcribed the bits in the journal that were about him and about me and the years that we had been together. And none of those got directly made into a poem, but they informed the way that I shaped these poems. And they were valuable for me because during a time when I couldn't shape a narrative, I could only sort of moan. I felt like I was doing something. And then I just started to go back through my journals and pull things out and pull little fragments of things out and then start to build them in different ways. And things got more complicated. I had the day after he died in a friend's house who I knew, who was his drug supplier. And I had spoken to his friend and yelled at him and screamed at him and said all the things that a grief-stricken mother might say, you know. And then I thought I hadn't given him really a voice. And I thought again about what he said to me on the phone, the drug dealer friend, that he was a friend. He was my friend. And so I wanted to write a poem to give him a voice without my screaming hysterical mother thing. And then I thought I was able to think of other things about what they say to you when someone dies. You know, oh, he's in heaven with Aunt so-and-so. You know, just these and the things that people say about drug deaths that don't really help at all. You know, I also talked to some other mothers who had similar issues, lost their sons or daughters, and it helped me see it as a larger issue. And at a certain point, I started pulling the poems together, and I thought, you know, I need to move towards joy in some sense. You know, I need to find some way. I have to find joy. And so there's a long poem in there where I recreate moments with him when we were communicating through music, because we both love music. And there are times when he'd say to me,
The versions of heaven.
He would say, "Mom, listen to this song. Listen to the lyrics especially. It's exactly how I feel." And then sometimes when we'd be arguing and we couldn't speak, and he'd put something on that we both loved and it would speak. And you know, so I like that. I wanted to avoid sentimentality and just but I wanted to also say there were these happy moments. And then one of the final poems is about the color red. I think it's called Reasons to Live, the Color Red. And that was an exercise I gave myself. Just I said, what is my favorite color? Red. And let me find some joy in those colors and moving forward. And because I wanted to end on that note, that was a forward-looking note. And so then it started coming together. I also had – I do tarot cards. I collect tarot cards. And I sometimes use tarot cards to help me write poems just by riffing off of them. So one summer – I did this the summer before he died and after. I was just pulling cards and trying to – find ways to write poems. And I was just getting swords all the time, which is the difficult suite. This is a suite of difficulty. And some of the poems that I wrote are in that book. There's a whole theme of poems that come from meditations on tarot cards with the suite of swords. And I liked having those because those are just slightly different, slightly more meta, if you will, than the ones that are very literal. There's a Facebook post from Gray in there as a found poem, which was I'm probably going to read that tonight. It's a piece. It's something he wrote. He rarely posted on social media, but about 2 weeks before he died, around exactly this time, right before Thanksgiving, he made this long, long post about being thankful for his life and how some things wouldn't change, but he appreciated those who stuck around, friends and family, said, "You know who you are." And then a couple of weeks later, he would be dead. And I still to this day think of that as a kind of maybe him saying goodbye and it's going to be okay, you know, but I have to go. So the listeners might not be familiar with the expression "a found poem," but it's something when you find something that seems it needs little, but maybe breaking lines here and there, and it's a poem without you doing much else to it. So that's in there. And I had a great editor too, who challenged me at every stage. And I can tell you that book went through many, many, many revisions. And I was lucky to have an editor who was kind and compassionate, but very firm. And you need that when the subject matter is as emotional as it is. Yeah.
Well, you can feel the beauty and the sorrow and the firmness and all of that in this book. If you have just tuned in, my guest, Cheryl St. Germain, is talking about her book just recently published, The Small Door of Your Death, about her son, Gray, who passed away 4 years ago. She will be reading from some of that this evening, but that, I think, was published by Autumn House Press. Mm-hmm. And again, I have your stack of books here, and I have them in chronological order. And I think it just, as I was going over them, knowing you were coming, the maturity and purity and depth that has grown in your work is beautiful. And it's a lovely thing that you share it with all of us, all of the details and all of the desire that it touches our heart, and that we understand that all of these experiences are really all in the same swamp. And so we're so glad you're here. As I mentioned earlier, you're here not only to receive the Writer's Award from the Louisiana Book Festival, but you are reading tonight in Lafayette. People can hear you at 7 o'clock at the Achilles Print Studio. It's open to everybody. I think you'll be reading a couple other places, too, in Louisiana, if anyone's listening or going. Are you going to give a reading in Baton Rouge
No, but I'm on several panels. They don't do readings there. They do. It's more discussion. So I have a panel with Daryl Bork and a panel with Jack Bedell where we're talking about my work. But I'm giving a reading in New Orleans at the Dogfish reading series. That's next. What is today? Today is Thursday,
the 8th.
So next Thursday. I think that's at 7 o'clock. And I'm also doing a reading in Hammond at Southeastern. On Wednesday at 2 o'clock. I'm not sure where that is.
So a few places. But we do have to say that you have announced you are retiring.
Yes.
Publicly, you did announce that, and that what that means, in addition to having more time for writing, you will be spending more time in Louisiana, I think you hope to do.
Yes. And my husband and I are planning to spend the spring of 2020 to start off with, because I love spring in Louisiana. So, yeah.
So hopefully we'll get to hear you read more often, and you'll be in our communities more often as well.
So, I hope so.
Yeah. Well, so glad to have you here. Again, writer Cheryl St. Germain receiving the 2018 Louisiana Writer Award this weekend at the Louisiana Book Festival. Tonight, 7 o'clock, she is in Lafayette in the Oil Center at Achilles Print Studio. So good having you with us, Cheryl.
Thank you. So good to be here, Judith. Thank you so much.